Welcome, everybody, to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today, 941-877-1552, or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. We shine only when we make you shine. Our very special guest today is legendary hitmaker Tommy James of the Shondells, who has also written a best-selling book about his infamous and often intimidating association with Roulette Records and the godfather of the music business, Morris Levy. After Tommy James and his family moved to Niles, Michigan, he assembled what became a very popular local act called the Tornadoes. A local DJ asked the band to sign with his new label called Snap Records. One of the tunes recorded was a catchy rock and roll ditty written by Jeff Berry and Ellie Greenwich called Hanky Panky. The song quickly became a local hit and then rapidly faded away into oblivion. 2 years later, an improbable occurrence unfolded when Hanky Panky was discovered in a record bin by a nightclub DJ in Pittsburgh. He began playing the newly discovered 45 at weekend dances, and the response was beyond overwhelming. A local record distributor bootlegged it and sold 80,000 copies in just 10 days. By May of 1966, Hanky Panky became a number one hit in Pittsburgh. Later, a promoter hunted down Tommy in Niles, Michigan, and urged him to come to Pittsburgh, where he was already a huge sensation. A young and impressionable Tommy James would soon be trying to sell Hanky Panky to the largest record companies in New York. With an original copy from Snap Records and a bootleg copy in hand, the executives from all the major labels positioned themselves to sign the rock and roll boy wonder. Strangely, the next morning, Tommy received a phone call informing him that all those record companies that were so eager to sign him had decided to pass. A disconcerted James then received a call from Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records, who informed Tommy that he received a call from Morris Levy, president of Roulette Records. The message was made clear, crystal clear, to Wexler and all the other record execs. Levy said, "This is my effing record. Leave it alone." Hanky Panky became number one on the charts in America and the biggest summer hit of 1966. Thus became the infamous relationship between Tommy James, Roulette Records, and music mogul gangster Morris Levy. After every crime family member connected to Roulette Records had passed away, Tommy James was compelled to profess his incredible story. So with help from author Martin Fitzpatrick, James confessed his story into a book called Me, the Mob, and the Music, which became a Simon & Schuster bestseller. Tommy James has sold over 100 million records and was awarded 23 gold singles plus 9 gold and platinum albums. Some of his legendary hits include Hanky Panky, I Think We're Alone Now, Money Money, Crimson and Clover, Crystal Blue Persuasion, Sweet Cherry Wine, and Dragging the Line. During 1968 and 69, Tommy James and the Shondells sold more single records than any artist in the world, including the Beatles. Today, it's my great pleasure to welcome legendary hitmaker and best-selling author Tommy James to the show. Hello, Tommy.
Hi. Hey, that was pretty good. That was good.
I tell everybody after the intro, well, we're done. I'll see you next time.
Yeah, take care.
Well, you
well,
know,
thank you so much. It's great to talk with you.
It's great to talk to you, too. In today's age, you got to get all your kudos in, you know what I mean?
Yeah, boy, you had all the stats and everything. That was great.
It's been a while. We want to, you know, reassure everybody what a legend you are.
Well, thank you so much.
You just finished a mini tour, kind of a mini tour. I know you do a lot of casinos and things like that as well that ended in, I think it was Juliet, Illinois.
We ended up in Chicago, yes, and it was, we tour every year, and, you know, we play basically all over North America this year, so it was a good year, we got a lot on our plate this year, and it was fun.
So when do you think you'll be hitting the road again? I think you came down to Florida, or is that still in the works? I saw a date there.
Yeah, we'll be coming to Florida, but we'll be actually in Pompano Beach this year. But we will be down in Florida. We're going to be we'll start touring again probably in February, I think is our first date, and we usually go from about February and March to about October, sometimes November, and then we're off for the rest of the year. So.
Oh, wow.
It's been like that for a long time, yeah.
Yeah. Do you still like touring? And
I do. It's I'm not nuts about traveling, that's for sure. But, I love performing, and the fans are great. And, I look out at our concert crowd now. I literally see three generations of people, and it is really wonderful.
That's pretty cool, yeah. What about... Are you still doing any of the European circuits or anything like that?
Well, every now and then we'll make it to Europe, but I'd much rather play the U.S. and Canada than go overseas right now.
Yeah.
We're doing so many other projects right now that I really can't go away for an extended period of time. So I'm glad to be. Home Sweet Home looks pretty good right now.
Oh, good.
Everything that's going on.
Exactly. You're kind of afraid to even get on an airplane nowadays.
Yeah, I know.
It's really a shame. It was never like
sure
that
do.
Back in your time, in my time. We never had to worry about that. Maybe an occasional hijacking to Cuba, but that was about it.
Yes, right. Just one of those pesky hijackings, right?
Yeah, we can handle that.
Yeah, well, it really is true, and I really think it's so important to stay out there as a working act for the fans. Being a working act really makes everything else that you do sort of come to life. At least that's the way it is for me. And the fans have been so great to us over the year. I really thank the good Lord and the fans for the kind of longevity we've had. It's really been amazing. This is going to be, next year will be 50 years, if you can believe that.
I
can't believe it either. And then it was, that's 50 years in the major leagues. It was another 5 years in the minor leagues before that. So, we've been doing this a long time.
Exactly. Well, you've been you were on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame show with John.
Yeah, this year it was really kind of unexpected. Joan Jett was being inducted into the hall, and her manager, Kenny Laguna, is an old friend of mine and a production partner, and as a matter of fact, was in the Shondells for a period of time. And so Joan asked me if I would perform Crimson and Clover with her, and I said, sure, we'll do that. So as things got closer, the event got bigger and bigger, and so finally, by the time we were on stage together, Miley Cyrus came on to sing background, Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters and Nirvana, and before we were done, when we actually performed Crimson and Clover, there was four generations of rock and rollers doing Crimson and Clover. It was really a magic moment, so it was very cool.
Did you know they were coming out on stage during the song, or they just kind of...
Yes, I did. I learned, at rehearsals and stuff, but it was really... Very a great honor and really a really magical moment.
Now, currently, you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is that right?
That is true. My feeling has always been, when it's our turn, we'll go. I'm magnanimous about it.
Right.
sooner or later, it's going to happen.
Well, you guys are the pioneers of rock and roll, and I tell this also to Tommy Rowe. I mean, Tommy Rowe should definitely be in there,
Yes, Tommy's a Tommy's a great artist.
Back in the late 50s, with Sheila.
Yeah. Sure.
But I agree with you. You'll eventually be in there. I'm not a big fan of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
No, a lot of people aren't. But I think half the fun though is being angry at him.
Yeah.
Half the fun is being mad at the Hall of Fame for not getting your favorite act in.
Maybe they do that on purpose. Who knows?
So when you do get in finally, it's this great sigh of relief when nobody talks about it anymore. You know.
Exactly. I had this conversation with Ian Gillan, the lead singer from Deep Purple, and he's recently in the news. He's how angry he is of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they were nominated, but they didn't make it in. And as soon as he's nominated and he gets in, then it's all over. You know.
Yeah.
You won't hear
me. Well, listen. I always think there's something kind of unseemly about. You know, artists who complain that they're not. I always think there's something. I don't know. Maybe it's my Midwest upbringing. I don't know. But I always think it's a little left of center when I hear groups do that. You know.
Well, you'll be in there because you're a top 40 hit maker. You know.
We're going. It'll happen.
Yeah. You'll get in there, and if for some reason you're not in there soon, I'll start a petition and I'll go haywire. We'll get you.
Okay. Well, that's for the fans to do.
Right. Right. Well, I'm a big fan besides being a journalist, so we'll
oh, well, thank you.
I'll start it up. You just you're back in the studio again, right?
We're in the middle of doing a new album. Yeah.
Is that called Acoustatronics?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes, it's called Acoustatronics.
Okay.
And it's basically this is a project I would have done back in the '60s if I'd have thought about it. But it's basically using all acoustic instruments. We do some electronic instruments, but basically it's not Michael rowed the boat ashore. You know, when we say acoustic guitars, we mean, meaty rhythm stuff. And it's really interesting to use acoustic instruments instead of a lot of synthesizers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you could say it's kind of a backlash against all the technology. But we're having a great time doing it. You know, real drums and acoustic bass. I don't mean the upright bass. I mean the acoustic bass guitar.
Right.
And it's just a lot of fun. We're also creating a lot of hybrid instruments. You know, like for example, instead of using a crunch guitar, mm-hmm. we would take, for example, we did last week. We took. The bass notes on an acoustic piano and play them in fifths and then created a chord and then ran the chord through a compressor until it had that really hard edgy sound that that a fuzz or acoustic or electric guitar would have.
Right.
And that we used in place of a crunch guitar, and it was very effective. And, all kinds of interesting sounds like that. So it's going to be a fun project. It should be out in about, March or April. And it's going to be on our label, Aura Records, and distributed internationally, overseas by Sony, and here in the United States by MVD. So we're really looking forward to getting this one out.
So are these all new songs?
There's going to be three songs, but three songs that will be from the movie.
Oh, really?
The movie that we're doing, there's three classic redos done acoustically of Crystal Blue, I Think We're Alone Now, and Dragon Line, and then the rest are all new.
Oh, wow!
So it's going to be it's really a nice mixture of stuff.
Yeah.
And I hope the fans dig it.
Oh, they'll love it, of course. You've got some special guests on there, too. Is it Steve Van Zandt?
Yeah, Stevie Van Zandt came on and played. He's going to play in several songs. Gene Cornish, my old friend from the Rascals, is coming.
Rascal. Yeah.
Kate Taylor, James Taylor's sister, who is a great artist, is coming on. He's going to do some vocals. And, friends of mine from all over are going to be coming into it. So it's going to be an interesting collection of people.
Right. That's going to be a great project. We definitely are looking forward to that.
Well, thank you.
Last time we chatted, I guess back in 2011, you had lots of things going on, including you had a stage show, like a Broadway show of Me, the
Right.
Mountain, that was going to be out. You also had the movie was in the works, and I think
Right.
things were you were still kind of tweaking some things. What's the latest?
Well, there's a lot going on. First of all, the movie is we finally have the script in the works. The screenplay is being written by Matthew Stone, who's a terrific screenplay writer, producer. The production and producer is Barbara DeFina, who produced Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Yeah, Goodfellas and Casino and Last Temptation of Christ. And I'm going back in the 80s. She starred with The Color of Money with Paul Newman. And,
yep.
You know, just an amazing string of hit movies. And so she's doing this, and also, as I say, Matthew Stone's doing the screenplay. We will be picking a director right after the screenplay. That's the next thing that happens, and then they start doing the casting. So, you know, it's been a long time coming. It's been a project that has been in the works for several years. They've decided to wait on the Broadway show until after the movie, you know, because the truth is, you know, you do the Broadway show, if it's not a big success, the movie never gets made, so it's really important to do it this way.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I'll be doing the music for the movie. There'll be, you know, it's an interesting combination of drama. Our story is almost more of a drama with music in it than a music movie with a storyline. You know, it's really got it's a whole lot more drama than is normally in one of these types of movies,
right?
Because of the crazy situation that was involved with, and plus the fact it's all true.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Right.
It's impossible. Now, you had some people in mind as far as being Morris Levy. I remember before.
Well, there's several people right now, and I as we're doing this, I'm getting an amazing education. First of all, Barbara DeFina, who does these incredible mob movies. You know, she's a petite little thing, about 5'1", and she is, you would never in a million years picture her as doing these kind of films.
Yeah.
But she's really an amazing human being. She I don't ever want to play chess or poker with this gal, I'll tell you that. She really has this amazing ability to just, you know, take a little bit here, a little bit from there. She sees everything that's going on. And she's educating me as far as what's going on with the cast, because we really need, you know, in her words, you know, you got to have your lead players have to be what they call bankable, which means they have to be well-known enough to be big box office attractions, but
right.
yet they have to be unknown enough to be still be scary,
yep.
you know, because, yep. you know, when you've seen somebody 100 times, you know, they're not nearly as scary as an unknown actor playing, you know, one of the mob guys or something,
right.
you know, so... It's really a fine line, and it's really interesting to see her pick and choose people.
Do you have anybody in mind that you've been thinking about to play the part? Or?
Well, I do, but you know the thing of it is, I don't want to jinx it by telling you who we're talking about. The thing of it is, you know, it's the tough one is me, and I'm actually the tougher one is Morris Levy. You've
right.
got to find the exact right character. But then people ask me who's going to play you, and I have no idea because I'm the worst one to ask. really, it's like looking in a mirror and picturing
yeah.
something. It's probably going to be a young musician
right.
who plays guitar as badly as I do. That's the prerequisite right there. And it's tough to find that. They usually play guitar much too good.
That's funny. Well, I've been looking forward to this project for a long time. You know, I read the book a long time ago, and it's a perfect story. It's never been told. First of all, about the way the record industry, you know, pretty much was back in the '60s. You know, even though there was a lot going on, they still made stars out of people. You know, and they still had.
Well, that's true. That is true. And you know, when I first got into the business, there were some 300 labels that you could have legitimate hit records on.
Right.
Today, there's three. There's three distributors, essentially out of North America.
That's
and you know, Sony just bought EMI, and EMI had purchased BMG before that, and so you know, all the big fish are eating the smaller ones, and so today that you have Universal, you have Sony, and you have Warner Brothers,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty much it,
yeah.
as far as big distributors are concerned.
Right.
And so, you know, it's really a very different, and it's also a very different delivery system today. You know, with all of the mobile gadgets and everything today, and of course it's all digital today.
Yeah.
So it's hugely different.
I miss
yeah.
the old days. Going to the record
very,
store,
very
picking up for an
yeah.
album, you know. Going to the
right.
concert when they came around. And you know, concerts were very cheap back then because you guys were basically promoting the new album. You know, it wasn't about...
Right, the idea was to sell records. Well, the
yeah.
idea now is just is you get records in front of people to sell the concert tickets.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
it's just the opposite today.
Yeah, they got way out of hand with concert prices nowadays. They really have.
Yes,
like,
they
I
have.
I can't fathom spending, you know, like $300 to $500 to see the Rolling Stones.
Oh, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I won't do it.
That's crazy.
I'm lucky enough I get free tickets. If all I have to do is cover the show and I get free tickets. So
right.
I'm pretty lucky that way.
Well, you know, we're in a very different moment, and I always have felt that, you know, the basic relationship between the artist and the fans really hasn't changed all that much.
Right.
But everything else has.
Yeah.
You know, the way music is dealt with today, and you have a very different kind of crowd today. I was just talking with Stevie Van Zandt the other night. Stevie and I go back a long way, and you know, musically, and even though he's Springsteen's guitar player and does a lot of projects on his own, he's also very smart in terms of you know, the history of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking, and just how different the audiences are today. Now I have a great, I mean the audience, how much they're alike, and how different the whole system is,
right.
other than
right.
the audience. So I, you know, I feel like I'm very lucky to have made it when I did, because artists today, it's so difficult for young artists to get their music in front of people. It really is.
Oh, it's horrible. You know, and you know, a lot of them say you got to have so many amount of hits on YouTube before anybody hears
right.
right. you, you know, all that stuff. And it's bad. Because back
correct.
In your day, they had the garage bands, and at one time,
yeah,
you know,
and you could make it out of you could
yeah.
make it out of a single market. you know, I mean, we made it out of one market, Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And you know, every station, every city back then, every major city.
Right.
Had, you know, the 50,000-watt station and a 5,000-watt station. And the 5,000-watt station was sort of the farm team.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could blow it out in one market. You know, you could break out of one market, like Chicago or L.A. or somewhere. You know way to do that today.
Exactly.
And
yeah, you were huge.
So I get asked by a... Pardon me?
Go ahead. I'll listen.
Well, I was going to say, I get asked by a lot of young bands what to do. And
I
keep saying, I think there's a way to beat the system, and I think basically the right way is that young groups write, go into the studio at their own expense and make some demo tapes, and then go to a publisher instead of a record company.
Right.
Because a publisher is where the money is
mm-hmm.
right now, and it's also where the action is. So a publisher can open doors for you if you, for example, make some kind of 50-50 co-publishing deal with a publisher, so that they have a vested interest in your success.
Right.
It makes a whole lot more sense than trying to go to a record company and banging your head against the wall, because they're not signing anybody and they don't have any money.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
they're not even signing the legends anymore. You
right.
know,
that's right.
Most of these guys that I interview now are on independent labels, you know, small independent labels.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
And, but that, and that really... is the way it's been for quite some time, and you know, it's not getting any better. But if you go to a publisher can then open doors, get your music in movies,
right.
get your music in commercials, and mm-hmm. places that people actually hear your music.
Hey,
so,
some of the best some of the best music I've heard today are like on video games.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
So that's one way of making money.
Unfortunately, that's true. Yeah. Yep.
The real soprano characters used to hang out.
Yeah.
At Roulette Records. A lot of people don't know that, but the Sopranos were pretty much based on the guys you hung out with.
Well, that's true. The gist of the story of the book is that the reason why it was so scary up at Roulette is because essentially it was, you know, Roulette was a front for the Genovese crime family in New York.
Right. Yeah.
And of course that made life real interesting, but it also we couldn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Hesh Rabkin, for example, on the old Jewish record promoter that used to rip off all the black artists. Well, that was taken from Morris Levy,
mm-hmm.
the head of Roulette Records. Hesh, they called Morris Moish. And so, Hesh was Moish.
Right.
And with the horse farm in upstate New York and all that stuff, and that was Morris Levy. So, except Hesh was a much less scary than Morris really was. So, Stevie and I have, because of course Stevie was on, he played, on The Sopranos, he played Dante.
You got to get him in your movie.
Yeah, I'd love to. I really would. But I mean, the point is that it's funny because 2 weeks ago they had a Sopranos reunion mm-hmm. in New York at the Cutting Room, and Stevie asked me to come play, and I did. I played a couple acoustic songs, and I was introduced by Pauly Walnuts.
Oh man, that's funny.
And that was a real trip, and so it was fun because I was a big fan of the Sopranos and. Mm-hmm. And what they did, but anyway, the point is that that was Roulette Records, that was ground zero for all that stuff. So interesting. I think the fans will be interested in hearing the story.
Oh yeah,
it's going to make a good movie.
Yeah, oh yeah, fantastic movie. You know, it's amazing how Morris Levy's forte was in the music industry. You know, was he? I guess he was that knowledgeable too, right? As far as music,
Morris. Was an amazing character.
Uh-huh.
He had good ears. You know, he could hear hits.
Yeah.
And I grew to respect Morris at a lot of different levels. Of course,
right.
doing business was a disaster because
right.
they just weren't going to pay, you know.
Yeah.
But we, of course, were making money from concerts and from commercials and from BMI and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But mechanical royalties were just not going to happen. And, of course, I guess once we constantly were under the gun as to do we try to get out of this thing? Do we sue them? Do we try to go to another label? And then, or do we stick it out here? Because we were having such success with Roulette.
Mm-hmm.
Success we probably would have never had anywhere else because they really needed us at Roulette.
Right,
and gave us the keys to the candy store in one respect,
mm-hmm.
and so I think we made the right decision by staying because, well, now I get to tell the story for one
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But it would have been very very dangerous to leave. I mean, if we had you know the Jimmy Rogers story of when he
yep.
tried to leave.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. But you know they were scary, but they also exhibited a sort of charisma as well.
It was, what I call an abusive father-son relationship, you know.
Exactly.
It was a strange relationship, but we sort of had an understanding. That's really the truth. And once you pass that hurdle, once
right.
you know, they know you're not going to come after them, legally.
Yep. Yeah.
Then they really opened up, and suddenly we were, we were basically the biggest act they had up there, and the only act for a long time.
Right. You were invited to his horse farm, right? At one time.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. That had been kind of scary.
Well, you know, not unless you're afraid of horses, I guess. But
well,
at the time, it wasn't a horse ranch. It was actually a dairy farm when I first went up there.
Right.
But that's Morris. You know, he had his hands in everything. He was making, I don't know, $100,000 a month doing milk for the local dairies, you know. So, yeah, it really was kind of amazing.
Well, during the mob wars, Morris left the country, right? And you were basically a sitting duck. That that must have been one of the scariest moments of your life, I guess.
Well, it was. I ended up going to Nashville.
Right.
I was. This is back. You're talking about in '71, and when. Well, I guess I'll just have to say it. The Gambinos were taking over New York City, and Morris was on the wrong side.
Right.
And he left the country with Nate McCalla, who was his sort of enforcer up there, and they went to Spain and left the rest of us at Roulette sort of holding the bag.
Right.
And I got a call from my lawyer to go talk with my lawyer, and who told me that it would be a real good idea if I left town till this thing blew over, because if they can't, if they go after Morris and can't find him, they'll go after whatever's making Morris money, and that, he says, that's you, and you can, wouldn't be smart to stay here. So I said, oh, that's terrific. I'm on the lam. So I have to pack up and go. I went to Nashville, and Pete Drake and I, along with Elvis's guys, DJ Fontana and Scotty Moore, did an album together. And it was one of the best albums I ever did.
Oh, cool.
Called My Head, My Bed, and My Red Guitar. And we did that album. And then I came back to New York after that. So
that's amazing.
That's how it went.
What a story, I'm telling you. You know, my dad, my father grew up in Bensonhurst. And
Is that right?
Yeah, he's Jewish. And he knew a lot of the guys from the old neighborhood that were...
Sure.
That were friends that became gangsters, you know. And we're kind of related to Levy is also one of the names that we're related to. So I'm kind of wondering, wow, it's possible.
Well, you know, because he was what they called an associate, because, you know, obviously being Jewish, he couldn't be officially inducted, you know.
And, yeah, but, exactly. Couldn't be a made man.
Yeah, so, but it was close enough, believe me.
Yeah,
they all hung out up there like it was, you know, like it was a social club. You know, they.
Right.
I was really amazed, and so you know, it was a pretty good idea to kind of not make a lot of eye contact.
Yeah, that's funny. We had bar mitzvahs, and we had actually had guys in the mob at these bar mitzvahs, because my Uncle Sammy in Brooklyn, in New York, he had retail electronic stores, and I think he was a little connected. So they would show up, and my father would say, see that guy over there? To say hi, shake his hand, and, you know, and move away from him, you know, things like that.
Right.
They were always in these really nice suits, you know, perfect, you know, manicured hands, and things like that. It was interesting, you know. It was kind of fun, too, in a way.
Well, you know, as long as you can observe things and not participate, it can be fun. I felt up there like I always, well, first of all, I had no fear because, well, I was young and stupid for one thing, but I basically was, you know, I was looking at it strictly from the point of making records.
Mm-hmm.
And but every now and then, you know, reality would kind of close in. They, all kinds of things were going on up there, and you basically wanted to just kind of look at the floor and leave, you know, leave quietly when all that stuff would happen.
Well, you were lucky. You can only, you know, your thing was just making money for them. Music-wise, and
I was a good earner, unfortunately.
They didn't call you on the side and say, "Hey, Tommy, I want you to take care of this thing." You know?
Oh no, it was nothing like that. No, I was, you know, it was definitely understood. We were, you know, we were civilians, and we were music guys. So I mean that never, but it was just you know, the point was that you didn't want to push them for your money. If they weren't going to pay it, they weren't going to pay it. You just basically accepted what they did and or leave or try to leave.
Right.
Which we might have been able to do, but I really was very unnerved about doing that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And
finally, in 70, we did finally in 74.
Right.
And we had it. Morris and I had a big blowout, and that was a pretty scary moment. Yeah.
Well. Now you got some of your money back, didn't you?
Yes.
Some of your okay.
Well, you know, Morris was indicted in '86.
Right.
And went to trial. Was sentenced to 10 years in prison for racketeering.
Mm-hmm.
And before he went to prison, was supposed to go to prison, he sold roulette. And he sold Big Seven Music, the publishing company, and EMI bought the masters. Warner Brothers bought the masters.
Right.
EMI bought the publishing, and so suddenly I'm getting, getting the checks that I should have been getting right along.
Exactly.
And then, of course, just before he was supposed to go to prison. In 1990, he died of cancer.
Right.
And so that was a very, I had a lot of mixed emotions about it because, if it hadn't been for Morris Levy, there wouldn't have been a Tommy James.
Right.
And that's
the truth. You say that, but then he told all the other record kind of companies to stay away from you. So.
Yeah.
You really don't know.
So it was really a mixed bag. And so, I mean, I suppose if we hadn't had the success we had at Roulette, I wouldn't feel that way. But, and if we had gone, I can tell you right now that if we had gone with one of the majors, like one of the corporate labels like CBS or RCA,
mm-hmm.
I can tell you that with a record like Hanky Panky, we would have been lucky to have been a one-hit wonder.
Yeah,
you know, we would have been. We would have been had all the competition of all the other acts that were on the labels.
Right, right.
So it was a good chance we would have got lost in the numbers. And secondly, we would have been turned over to an in-house A&R guy who, wouldn't have known what to do with us. At Roulette, we were allowed to morph into whatever we could become.
Right.
And so I know there's no way we would have had the kind of success. At one of the other labels, even like at Atlantic or Capitol, I know we wouldn't have had the kind of sort of street level success that we had at Roulette. Just wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So when he died, I had a lot of mixed feelings.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. He was almost like a member of the family, really. Like an uncle.
True.
That was into all that stuff. Morris Levy also went after. He also went after John Lennon. So that's
he was an equal opportunity destroyer. He had no respect for anybody. He conned John out in the 70s out of an album, and it all came down to the old song "Come Together," and "Come Together" sounded very much in Morris's opinion like a song that. Chuck Berry had written,
right,
and earlier in the late 50s, and which it did. The name escapes me right now, but at any rate, he had publishing on it, and years after "Come Together," he decides he's going to sue John Lennon for "Come Together," and he did, and it looked like he was going to win. And he actually ended up threatening John, and it was pretty hairy. He took John up at the farm, and at that time his girlfriend was May Pang, I think, and
right.
And May actually told me this story that Morris threatened them, both of them, up at the farm.
Wow.
And so anyway, John ended up winning the case in the end, but Morris put out an album called Roots. mm-hmm. and it was that John had recorded, right. and that's as far as it got. But it was a whole scene, and I, you know, I learned more about it all the time. I actually learned a lot more about it after I wrote the book. But you know, more that was Morris.
Sure. Yeah. And he was notorious, too, for the cutout albums. I remember
yes,
he put Dragon the Line out.
Yeah. Dragon the Line was still top five. And I look on TV, and there's an ad. It's a cutout on some oldies album.
You know, I bought that album.
Yeah, did you really?
I did. I bought that album.
Yeah, so, I mean, and so, I mean, you know, I was freaking out there. You know, what in the world is going on here?
That's something else.
True story.
It is a true story. That's what I like about it. I mean, you can't, like I said, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
Yeah. Now, Crystal Blue Persuasion. You know, there's a lot of myths about that. You know, that was actually wasn't that related to, I don't know, maybe the Book of Isaiah and Book of Revelation?
No, the Book of Revelation. Book of Revelation in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's a story of a crystal blue persuasion. You know, the meaning of the song is about becoming a Christian, and which is what happened to me right at that moment. And you know, there was no such thing as political correctness back then, and that was a snapshot of how I felt at that moment, and we put the record out, and over the years, everybody thought it was about drugs.
Right.
You know, a couple of years ago, it was on Breaking Bad, and on the finale episode of the next to last season, and you know, they're going through all the selling the drugs, the crystal meth and all that, and they do Crystal Blue Persuasion. I say, no, that isn't quite what the thing was about.
I know.
I guess you take it where you can get it.
Right. I guess any publicity is good publicity.
I suppose so.
And I love the your appearance on Ed Sullivan, which is a classic, and you can still see it on YouTube. But
oh, yeah.
He's like everyone else, he screws up your name.
Of course. Yeah, the week before the first Ed Sullivan show, true story, we had just finished a tour across Canada with the Beach Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And this is January of 69. And Crimson and Clover was going number one that week. And so it was a big moment, and we were doing the Sullivan show, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, so I wanted to see the warm-up, to, you know, because he was announcing next week's acts.
Mm-hmm.
And two of the Beach Boys are with us and the Shondells, me and the Shondells, in the room in L.A., in the hotel. And he said, next week, right here, Tony Jones and the Spondells will be here. Tony Jones and the Spondells, which means he can't read and he never heard of you.
No, he never did his research. Never did his research.
No,
you know?
No, he thought he was winging it. Plus, he'd get loaded by the end of the show, so you never knew what was going to come out of his mouth.
He always sounded loaded. I always wondered about that.
He did get a little tipsy by the end of the show.
Yeah, but, you know, if it wasn't for Ed, we wouldn't have so many, you know, great acts. You know, so... But, you know, I don't understand why he... I guess wasn't his thing to, you know, do the...
You just... Surgery. Well, you know, Ed was not... Ed needed glasses, and he couldn't read very well, and so sometimes he'd get it right. Engelbert Humperdinck, he has no problem with. James, James, he can't pronounce. Go figure.
He had problems with Rich Little, too. I remember Rich Little.
Yes,
right. Yeah, that's funny, but we kind of miss those pioneers. You know, we don't have those guys anymore. You know,
it's true. It's a very different world without all those guys.
Yeah, it is.
You better believe it.
I was always hoping guys like you would step up and take the reins.
Well, somebody really ought to do a new 21st century version of a variety show.
Yeah.
On TV.
Right.
You know, somebody really ought to do that with the music acts and everything, because that's one of the things that's definitely missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're missing a lot of things, unfortunately. Tommy, here's a question that I ask everyone I interview. It's kind of a fun question. I get some interesting answers.
Right.
If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, man.
I know you work with so many great artists.
Wow. I think that I'd like to write with some of the great writers from like the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd love to do a duet with like Joe Stafford or something.
Right.
You know, they wrote such incredible music back then.
Mm-hmm.
And the songs were just, you know, they were like the movies. They were iconic. You know, they were crafted. I think that's what I'd like to do. I think I'd like to go back to the 40s and write with some of those guys.
Well, that was a great era. We can take a lot from that era too. I mean, you know,
you
just
bet.
The way people dressed back then, it was just so
well relaxed. The World War II. The whole World War II, the songbook from World War II is unbelievable.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, Smile all kinds of songs. One of those is escaping me right now, but Moonlight in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of those kind of songs, you know.
Right.
I would love to write. I would love to sit down and write a torch song with somebody who really was good at it.
Well, maybe this is the
That's
beginning.
Kind of my thing.
Maybe this is the beginning of things for you with writing music to the new movie and then the Broadway
show. You just never know. Well, you know, it's going to be interesting because at the very last scene in the movie, of course, is where Morris dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of have an imaginary conversation with him and say goodbye to him because I wasn't able to do it in real life.
Right.
And this is in the back of a limousine, and the limo takes off. It's in Chicago, and the camera pans back, and you see all the beautiful skyline of Chicago at night. And then this song comes on. It's going to be this brand new version of "I Think We're Alone Now," which is acoustic and slow and really beautiful, and it completely changes the meaning because, you know, Morris is gone and
mm-hmm.
we're alone now. So the meaning is so different from the teeny bop love song of '67,
yeah.
And yet the words hold up. So that's going on the album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be closing credits to the movie. That's one of the songs we did acoustically that I think is going to be very important. And then there's another song called "Distant Thunder" that's going to be the first single from the album, and that is also in the movie. So the movie and the album and the book are all interrelated, and I think our show on stage will be as well. So I'd kind of like to make them all, you know, sort of one thing.
Right. Well, I'm really looking forward to this. It's been a long time in the making. But, you know, good things are worth waiting for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know? We're probably looking at another 18 months to 2 years.
Really?
Before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you got everybody in place. The script, is the script done now, or is it still in the process?
The script will be finished in about, it should be. At some point in December.
Oh, in December, okay.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
So that's how quickly everything's happening now. Once you have the script, you know, then people commit. They don't commit without the script, you know. So getting the script just right is really amazing because it's the movie on paper.
Yeah. Well, make sure you get all your due credits and royalties from the movie and everything else.
Yes. Well,
I know that's another.
That's very true.
that's another part of it. I promoted I do some PR work as well, and Rex Pickett was a client of mine from he did Sideways,
oh, yeah.
The movie Sideways.
Uh huh. Right.
Unfortunately, he got taken for lots of money on this. You know, he couldn't do the second, the follow-up movie, and
it seems to be a reoccurring theme, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. It needs to be a reoccurring thing, but you know, he did okay on the first movie, but he signed his life away. He was so excited that they were making a movie out of his book, you know, that he signed
right.
his life away. So he regrets that.
You do have to be careful. Fortunately, I've got really wonderful people around me who are
good,
and I've lived long enough to know what to do and what not to do. So, you know,
yeah, you've been through it all, I think. If you can handle Morris Levy, you can handle anything.
Yes, I've been around the block a couple of times.
Hey, Tommy, what about children? Do you have any children or grandkids or anything
I
like
sure
that?
I sure do. I have one son, Brian, and we're going to be
Brian.
Spending, and he is, he and his wife are, and their family are going to be, we're all going to be spending Thanksgiving together along with my wife, Linda.
Okay.
And we're here in North Jersey, and just outside of New York, and it's going to be a nice holiday season. It always, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas are always great around New York.
Yeah.
New York is just a magic town when the holidays come around. So we're going to have a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I miss that. I'm originally from D.C. and we moved here in Florida about 13 years ago. It's just not the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you miss the fall and the change of weather.
A palm tree just doesn't get it at Christmas time.
It doesn't.
You can decorate them, they just don't look good with pine cones on them.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. Tommy, anything else you'd like to promote?
Well, just, you know, I'd love to see the fans. If they want to come to the shows, come to the website, TommyJames.com, and find out everything that we're doing. And that's basically it. I want to thank the fans for all their loyalty over the years, and hope we get to see people.
Well, we thank you for being a guest on the Ray Shasho Show today and for all the great music you've given us and continue to bring. We look forward to the new album, of course, Acoustitronics, and great things revolved around your best-selling book, Me, the Mob, and the Music. Can't wait. I've been waiting for this for a long time, Tommy, so tell
thank
me to hurry
you so
up.
Much. All right. You take care of yourself. It was great talking with you, Ray.
Me too, Tommy. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. You take care.
You too. Join me biweekly, Mondays at 3 p.m., 6 p.m. Eastern on the Ray Shasho Show. Very special thanks today to Carol Ross of Aura Entertainment Media, Marketing, and Public Relations for hooking us up today with the legendary Tommy James. Visit the Tommy James and the Shondells official website at www.tommyjames.com. And please, by all means, purchase Tommy James' best-selling book, which is about to become a movie, Me, the Mob, and the Music, and it's available at Amazon.com. And I believe if you go on his website, you can also order a autographed signed copy of the book. If you have any comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on the Ray Shasho Show, you can call me at 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworks.com. Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio, Station 1.